Welcome, everybody, to Getting to the Root of Modern Disease. In this self-empowering summit, we will envision a new paradigm for healing based on wholeness, tapping into foundational wisdom, both ancient and modern, to create the conditions that favor deep and lasting healing of body, mind, and spirit. Step out of the box with me and our panel of healers as we open a deep and transformative conversation that gets to the very root of our modern diseases and allows access to the healing powers that are your birthright. I'm your host, Gina Sager, and it is my deep honor and pleasure to welcome Dr. Tarya Ward today. Thank you, Tarya, for joining us.
Thank you, Gina, for doing this event. I can't wait to hear it all, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very honored and privileged to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you and can't wait to hear all of your wisdom come forth. Let me just introduce you to our audience.
Okay.
So Tarya Ward, PhD, has worked intensively with her own and other people's dreams for more than 40 years, and for nearly 20 years has been an avid student of indigenous ways of knowing and being. In 2004, she established Bridging Worlds, a center for working with individuals and groups to bridge the waking mind with the dreaming mind, the domesticated self with the indigenous self, culture with nature, the visible with the invisible, the conscious with the unconscious. Presently, she has a private practice specializing in dream analysis in Asheville, North Carolina, where she works with clients in person, by Zoom, Skype, or by telephone. She teaches an online 12-month course entitled Awakening the Ancient Ways, and she also offers dream groups, workshops, and lectures. Tarya previously was a minister in an interfaith organization for 20 years, a professor at undergraduate and graduate levels, and the owner of Bridging Worlds Retreat Center in the remote mountains of Western North Carolina, where she conducted regular retreats and vision quests. Oh my, Tarya, I'm so excited to hear all you're going to share today. Your topic is recovering indigenous psychology. So that's an interesting notion. I've never thought of it that way. Please share with us what indigenous psychology is and why it's calling you.
Okay. You know, I usually call it recovering the indigenous mind, but for some reason, I've been thinking so often lately of one of Jung's classic lines that I think of so very frequently is that the fate of the world hangs on a very thin thread, and that thread is the psyche of man, meaning human. You know, he was back in the era where, so it's the human psyche that the whole world is, the fate of the world is hanging on this thin thread. And it's never been that apparent. You know, that was sort of like, yeah, I get that. And climate crisis is happening. But right now I feel like, we can almost see it. You know, there's almost like a couple of humans that it hangs on the thin thread of. You know, it's like, what are we going to do about this psychology? And of course, that's a delusion. It's not just a couple of people. It's all of us who've created this situation. But I'm thinking about the psyche. We need to understand the origins of the psyche, what the psyche is. And so that's why I'm thinking in terms of indigenous psychology. And I've been a really serious student of indigenous, you know, studied with many from all different backgrounds and traditions. So not just one or the other, but people from all over the world, indigenous people from all over the world. I've worked with them, done vision quests with them, studied with them. So to me, the indigenous knowing, the indigenous psychology is that really archaic mind that exists pre-culture, pre the reason, rationality, pre-domestication, pre-trauma. Certainly, it's like, who are we as humans in the depths of our being, and where is our original makeup, and how do we get back? It's like we have veered so far off course from our origins of who we are as a species. And when we think about it, the indigenous mind is aeons old. As Jung says, it's archaic. The psyche is archaic. It exists millions of years beyond time. And so our cultures are very recent. And certainly the development of the rational reasoning mind and what we have done to domesticate the mind itself, even as many advances as we have and as much as we know to be grateful for it, on the other hand, it's become so dominant that it is destroying the indigenous mind. And the indigenous ways of knowing are in threat of extinction. That whole aspect of our own self, of our own being, is as in danger of extinction as the indigenous peoples are, as many of the species. This is where, you know, we're in for the sixth extinction, which could include our species. But it's that aspect of ourselves that we have to fight against the extinction of. So let me read this quote of Jung's. He says, "The psyche is not of today. Its ancestry goes back many millions of years. Individual consciousness is only the flower and the fruit of a season, sprung from the perennial rhizome beneath the earth. And it would find itself in better accord with the truth if it took the existence of the rhizome into its calculations, for the root matter is the mother of all things." So he's talking about this rhizome, which is the psyche, which is ancient and archaic. And we spend so much time on studying individual psychology, and, you know, a lot of our psychological work is, you know, working on our own issues, which is important and powerful. And, you know, I help people with that every day. However, we need to get back way earlier than that and understand who we are at the root of all this, prior to any of these traumas and events and even cultural issues. And then to understand, excuse me a minute.
And, you know, I'll just, if you don't mind if I throw this in, I think it's really important for us to remember, or perhaps to know for the first time, that we're not talking about indigenous people as other people. Uh-oh. We're talking about this collective unconscious. I don't know, you can speak it better than I, but it's, this is about all of us. I feel that the disconnection is so real for us at every level. When we hear the word indigenous, we think it's those people, but it's it is us.
Yeah, thank you so much. That is so important to what I'm saying, and I wasn't making it explicit enough. I really appreciate that. The truth is that our own indigenous nature predates. I mean, it's our ancestors are only a few generations back that lived in an enculturated way. Well before that, our ancestors lived in an indigenous way. So our ancestry is indigenous, each one of us. No matter what color our skin is, no matter who we think we were born from or what, you know, it's like we are indigenous. And that is the, you know, all of our ancestors have lived in an indigenous way and are trying to help us get back to the truth of who we are. So it's not just people of a certain tribe or color or ancestry. It's all of us, every single one of us. So thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's so important.
Yes.
And the indigenous way of knowing, I really do want to make this point, is to understand the human as just one part in the entire web of life, that we have really overvalued, certainly, the human, and thought that somehow we were here to direct all this, and that nothing is alive or has intelligence or rights or wisdom to share except us. And that human-centric notion, as Thomas Berry, one of my great teachers, said, the human has developed this autism. We have become like an autistic species. We're only talking to ourselves. We're only listening to ourselves. There's an autism that we have developed species-wide. So as brilliant as we are and think we are, there is a tragic loss of sensation of reality by this human-centric way that we think and live. And you know, just to know that all these millions of species, many of them that we're killing off those organisms in our own bodies, in our own cells, in our own minds, in our own souls, in our own hearts, and that we can't hurt the planet without hurting our own possibility of a balanced life. I love to tell the story of the first time I went to Africa. Actually, it wasn't the first time, but the first time I went out on the Serengeti Plains, where you see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles that are wild, which we never see in the Western world. It's, you just won't find it. So hundreds of miles of plains and plains and plains of wild nature, and all these herds of every kind of animal you can think of, and birds, and they're all sort of, all the species are working together, living together, predators and whatever, but they're all working out their lives together. And when I came home, I felt like that's a part of me that I've never been introduced to. I knew that those wild terrains were a part of my own psyche and psychology, and nobody had ever really showed it to me. Maybe you have to go there to experience it, but I don't think so. I think if we just understand, we are that. The earth is us. This is who we are. We're all one thing. We're all part of one community of life. So it changed everything about me. I mean, I was in a whole different place in my psyche and in my life when that discovery came, and it changed everything to know that.
It seems to me that that speaks also to either the illusion or delusion of our separateness. So many of our diseases, you know, the anxiety and the depression and addiction, you know, is, I think, rooted, at least to some degree, in thinking it's just about me.
Right. Yeah. And if I could put it
this way, I have trouble. I can't help myself without, like, embracing the fact that our individual manifestation is that of the collective disease.
Yeah.
Seeing ourselves does help. And we're reflecting and creating the environment in which we find ourselves.
I mean, it's a serious mental illness to think of ourselves as separate. Yes. I mean, that is just a disconnection from reality in a very critical, serious, tragic way. So I remember listening to, sorry, I've got a thing in my throat.
Important information coming forth.
Yeah, definitely. At the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, I think of this often. It was back in the late 90s, I think it was 97 or something, but they brought up together all these scientists and philosophers and religious people and, you know, all these people for the Earth Summit. They gave indigenous people 5 minutes. 5 minutes in all these days, the indigenous people had 5 minutes to give their, you know, what they had to say, which I wish it had been most of it. But one of the things they said was there are two ways to think about nature. One is that we are part of it, an integral part of it. The other is that we are separate from it. And both of those produce completely different approaches to how to run the world. So it's like, we got to get back to understanding the reality and the truth of that we are part of it, not separate from it. And they say that if the earth was shrunk to the size of a basketball, that the biosphere, which is the, you know, what supports all life on this planet, all everything on this planet, the biosphere would be as thin as a piece of cellophane around the ball. That is the delicacy and tenderness of what supports all life on the planet, all organic life, all of our lives, the air, the water, the everything in it. And so to disrupt that really delicate balance that holds us all together, all the 30 million species that are here together, is to disrupt all of life, and it's that fragile too. So we've got a lot to figure out. Like summit is going to, the talk is going to air at some point in the future, but today, just the day that we're speaking, is a day when the rainforests are burning. And the G7 summit offered $20 million to help put out the fires. And the president of Brazil said, no, thank you. He felt like it's colonizing them to accept this. So to not understand that this biosphere is all of us, and that the rest of the world really wants us all to survive, and to think of that as a separate issue from the rest of the world, we're in a really tragic, dangerous place right now. Whew. I know, we gotta let that in, right? Hopefully.
Well, and hopefully letting it in, not to succumb to despair.
Right, or anxiety, really.
Letting it in as we recover our awareness that if this is true, that we are part of the whole, mm-hmm. That everything we do matters. You know, I remember my yoga teacher training, I think I've said in another interview, but I'll say it again. I remember of all of the things that I learned, the thing that really stood out for me was this one little line in the manual that said, how would you behave differently if you realized that you were a single cell in a giant organism and that your health and well-being informed the whole? Mm-hmm. And honestly, in my life, that was the first time I ever heard or thought of something like that. You know, I was doing yoga, but I didn't think, mm-hmm. realize my responsibility. It's and so lately I've been using that word, and several of my speakers have used the term responsibility. Comes with a lot of baggage, but I'm saying response ability. We have the capacity to respond in a new way, mm-hmm. and it is incumbent upon us to start to do that, I think.
Yeah, I so appreciate that, and to really feel that every effort we make does affect the whole. And every sort of like carelessness that we exercise affects the whole. You know, sometimes I just eat in an unbalanced way, you know, and I think, I tell them not to pour poison in the river, but I'm pouring some poison in my body right now. So what's the difference? You know, I need to be a little more clear about the responsibility, right? Yeah, yeah.
And yet awareness, right, is the key. So I see it. I realize that this is not exactly what I meant or what is best.
Right.
I change what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The willingness to engage in a moment-to-moment way and to be aware. That's part of the disease, isn't it? Like, I don't notice. It doesn't occur to me that I even matter. It goes far back.
Right. Yeah.
Forth, I mean, we could talk for days or weeks or years about this. Because it is all interconnected. And if we remember what you're sharing with us, we really can change not just our personal experience, but the experience of the universe.
Yeah, Lawrence Vanderpost, who was a friend of Jung's, a great writer. I don't know if you know him. He's written wonderful novels and books, but scientist, environmentalist, anthropologist. But he said, and I always remember this, that he said, it's no accident that we've discovered that the smallest organization of matter, the atom, has the ability to blow up the whole species. And he said, in the same way, that's the power of the individual. It's like the smallest organization, you know, of our society, the individual has the power and the possibility to create, you know, what the atom can create in terms of destruction or absolutely creation. So to take our individual response, none of us are powerless. We all have that power of the atom inside of us. And to know that, you know, that hopefully is an antidote to despair or helplessness.
And I don't think we realize that we're not taught this. I wasn't taught this. I mean, the first time I even had any notion that I didn't have like a lifelong list of problems, mm-hmm. from the sort of traditional Christian background, you know, or original sin, the first time I had a glimpse of another world was when I started to study Buddhism. And I hear, you know, that the Buddha teaches basic goodness. And I'm like, oh my gosh, my life could have been totally different if I would have been living from that perspective.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah?
And yeah. so it's again, more responsibility to make sure that people understand so that they're not trapped in their own little cocoons mm-hmm. of despair, but just like see all of the possibility that is also there, because for whatever the problem, there's always an infinite number of possibilities above and beyond that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And all of our lives could be so different if we'd been taught from the first, you know, days that we're part of nature, that it's part of us, that plants can talk to us, that they have intelligence, that trees do the same, that animals, spirits, our teachers, you know, that if we had a sense of our intercommunication with all the species on the planet, what would that be like? You know, just starting at a very early age, how differently would we consider our responsibility to everything and our love for everything, not objectifying it, but absolutely having a heartfelt, loving experience of exchange. So, right. Yeah.
So how do we do that?
Well, I'll tell you, a number of things are in my mind about this. One of them is to recognize that in some sense, we're in kind of a trance state. You know, that as David Bohm, who's a physicist, says, thought is a system. So this system of thought that produces, we're separate from nature, we're above nature, we, you know, all the systems of thought, whatever they are, you know, you should own a home, you get to own property, you get to, you know, corporations are important, whatever all those systems of thought are, we as he says, thought thinks us rather than us thinking thoughts. And we need to reverse that. We think that we're the sort of author of these thoughts that are in our heads, but basically it's a sort of a trance system that we're born into that thinks us. And we think that we're thinking these thoughts, but they've come to us from this system that is outside of our original nature and our original experience. So to start thinking our own thoughts, that's something that Buckminster Fuller used to say all the time too. You have to do your own thinking. And he went into silence for 2 years of his life to try to unthink all the thoughts he'd been taught to think and start thinking for himself. So to come out of that trance state, which is passed on from generation to generation to generation to generation, and it can be so deeply embedded in the psyche and you cannot see it. So it's about waking up from the trance state. Now, one of the major tools that I believe in my experience, I more than believe I know, that is one of the major tools is the dream. It's getting back in touch with the dream experience and understanding that our dreams are our connection to that archaic psyche. Dreams think in that archaic way. And they're producing symbols that may be part of our daily life, but they're speaking, when they're speaking in the dream, they're speaking in a very symbolic way. And we can understand and interpret them in terms of their archetypal and their symbolic nature to communicate something really deeply, powerfully, universally true. And as Jung says, which I believe, a dream always tells you the truth and it's always on your side. It will tell you the unvarnished truth and it's always on your side. So, you know, if we want to know that we're connected to sort of the truth of reality, stay in touch with our dreams and learn to understand that nightly, and not only nightly, but 24/7 really, where that dream dimension is part of our ontological being. It's part of our experience. We just don't recognize or understand it as such. So that dreaming mind is always awake and having dreams. It's only at night that we tend to go in there and bring it back. But the Aboriginal people thought that the Western people were insane because we only dream at night. Yes. You know, they go in and out of that state of consciousness at all times. So for me, dreams are really powerfully important, very, very significant. And it's interesting, Gina, a crow just came and looked at me in the window right here. So that was beautiful. Anyway, I was starting to say, it's interesting, Gina, when I was having these thoughts the other day, I was watching this trance state go down through some generations in a family very close to me. And I saw how the sort of trance was in the grandfather, then it was in the son, then it was in the children of the son, now it's in the toddlers. And it's like, I can see that sort of delusional way of interpreting the world going down from generation to generation. And then I went to my to watch something before I went to bed, and I had taped this movie called The Manchurian Candidate. Have you seen that movie? I think it's back in the late 90s, early part of this century. And I'd heard it referred to that so-and-so is a Manchurian candidate, and I never knew what that meant. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna tape this film. It was on a channel. And I taped it and watched it right when I was having these thoughts. And the Manchurian candidate is about some people who were in the Iraq War, I think. And they had implanted in their brains these chips. So it's a little bit science fiction that taught them how to think so that they would kill and do, and they could be manipulated to, and then they got into the government and so forth, and they had this chip in their head that was telling them to do certain things. The thing that was waking up these people that had the chip in their head was their dreams. It was like they were starting to have the dreams, and the dreams bypassed all that. And so when they started talking to each other about their dreams, that's when they began to understand what was really going on. And that's where the story, you know, gets interesting.
Oh, wow.
But I thought, you know, I felt like synchronicity is a very powerful thing for me to be having these thoughts and then go into and watch this story, which is a sort of an archetypal story of, it's like those chips that are put in our brains through just these trance states of our ancestors that didn't know any better. They pass the trance down and down and down, but the dreams will tell us the truth, and they're going to get us out of this situation if we listen to them and pay attention to them. So anyway, that was, I was really kind of stunned when I saw that movie, and I thought, there it is. There's the whole story. And I think it tells it well. If you look at it in an archetypal and symbolic way, it's actually a true story. So, yeah.
And I think the problem for me, I'm certainly working on it, but I have always had sort of a really good gut feeling.
Mm.
And I have almost always ignored it. Because it doesn't make sense. So I have a dream. It's like, that doesn't make sense. I don't believe it. So my healing work truly has been, a piece of it at least, to like listen to, like, nothing is a coincidence. You know, like with the crow, I mean, I have a lot of animal messages. There's never an animal that crosses my path that I just don't go, what are you here to tell me?
Yeah.
You know, like when I have snakes all over the place and everybody's like, ooh, snakes. I'm like, no, wait. This is really important. You know, this is earth energy. This is transformation. I mean, and it's not about knowing the right answer. It's just about learning to pay attention in a bigger way.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's another thing that I really wish we were teaching, you know, right. And when we're just like drilled into our screens, we don't see the crow fly at the window. We don't see the snake slithering through the grass. We don't notice the horses galloping across the field. And if we don't notice those things, we're not going to notice the subtle messages that our body and mind, which I think mind is really more in the realm of quantum physics than our brain. Right. You know, we don't notice that stuff. And that's what we're training ourselves to do, to really start to trust whatever arises for us without getting out the scales. Well, I felt like this, but you said no, so never mind.
Right.
That is scales away.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's so true. You know, and in the indigenous ways of knowing, there's never an accident when a crow comes to look at the window. Just when I was starting to tell you that story, the crow, you know, checked me out. And in the indigenous way of understanding, all, you know, everything is participating. The mind of nature is very much aware of us and participating with us. one of the ways it shows up for me is when I find a feather, I know that I'm being seen and blessed, you know, and it knows, it kind of knows when I need that, you know, little touch of like, we got your back. We, you know, I see you. And there are so many ways. Sometimes, you know, just a little breeze will kiss you on the cheek and you know that it came at a meaningful moment. So to just really know that nature is, it's not a delusion. It's an actual reality that we live embedded in. Nature knows us. It knows us way better than we know ourselves, way better. And I could tell way too many stories about that. I mean, truly, I felt known and seen in a way that I had to learn from nature. Yeah. Yeah.
And wow, we could all use some more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it could be, if we allowed it to be our 24/7 experience of just being in that constant communication, you know, it wouldn't need to be just that magical moment that happens every now and then. It could be, in, you know, we could live in that magic if we'd allow for it.
And I think even those of us who don't maybe believe that, we do know it when we feel it, right?
Right.
You know,
yeah,
when you're in the presence of something that is above and beyond anything your cognitive mind can make sense of.
Right.
And it's inevitably a beautiful experience.
Right.
So what do you think, what makes us like not want to do that again? What keeps us resisting? What makes us not believe?
Well,
why do we start believing?
I think it's like I was saying, this sort of trance state that, you know, that we're in. And I think also it's denial is a very powerful thing. Any psychologist will tell you that, you know, all of us know, you know, the power of denial in our own ways, in our own lives. And, but I feel like because the shift toward a more sustainable way of living on this planet is likely to require a real shift in our economics, in our education system, in our personal way of living, in our ways of eating. There's going to be so much that's going to be required of us that denial is like, people don't really know how to break out of that denial. It's just like, they don't want to go there. People, I just see, you know, we all just glass over. It's like, and how do you break through that denial? And often it will require some kind of nervous breakdown.
No, I think it does. I think that's exactly true. And it's like Rumi says, whatever, what does he say? Something like, don't despair when you've been brought to your knees, because that's the perfect place from which to pray.
Yes.
Really, yeah. It's really saying, wait a minute, like this crisis is an opportunity if I say so.
Right. Yeah.
Start to use, you know, right, these circumstances to create opportunities so that we can see in a bigger way. Because if I may be so bold, the powers that be are not going to see this.
Right.
And so, and yet, our behavior and the way that we change in small ways is not going to be small. Like, you know, Margaret Mead, then, you know, never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world, because that's the only thing that ever does.
Mm-hmm. It's true, really so true.
Commit,
right,
your role,
right,
in the maintenance of life,
right,
on our home.
Yeah.
This is where we live.
Yeah, I ran into a quote by Joseph Campbell the other day where he was saying that the difference between a priest and a shaman. And he said a priest is somebody who's like educated and trained in a particular tradition, you know, and very knowledgeable about their tradition, and probably has, you know, a lot of personal experience and, you know, beautiful sort of connection to what they're teaching about. But he said a shaman generally is the one who's had a crisis, a psychological crisis of some kind of physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual event that is a crisis. And out of that reaches into the depths of how to connect to the inner worlds and bring back the kind of healing that only that kind of experience will allow for. And so, and Thomas Berry, again, one of my great teachers, and I recommend anything he's written to anybody. He used to say that the shaman's role. It used to be like there was one shaman in the village that did this work of going in and getting the healing for the individuals. But he said, now we don't have time for one at a time. He said, it's time to wake up the shamanic dimension of our own selves and psyches, and that it's in all of us, just like the Dreamtime self is in all of us. It's like the shamanic dimension of the psyche is in all of us, and it's time for each of us to take responsibility, as you're saying, responsibility for that shamanic work. But it does often come because some kind of crisis has come. So I would say if crisis is approaching, you know, any of us, for us to just respect, you know, the creative possibility, rather than resist and resent and project and worry and fear. You know, if there's a way to just understand the crucial and critical nature of how sometimes that addresses us and initiates us into greater reality.
And then you're speaking to the importance, at least for me and in my teaching and in my personal work, of not expecting for everything to be perfect and beautiful all the time. I mean, this is not, if I may be so bold, positive psychology. Like, you just, like, this is about really understanding that dark and light coexist, yin and yang, the sun rises and sets, you know, there's the nighttime and the daytime. And we're like this too. We get sort of skewed. You know, my background story for most of my life was, if you do everything right, you're not going to have any trouble. So then when stuff happens, it's like, what did I do? It would have been so much more helpful to me to understand, you know, what I first learned in the Buddhist teachings, you know, the truth of suffering. Because then I wouldn't have been surprised. It's shocking to me that I lived 40 years of my life, like, not knowing that shit happens.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hysterical. I'm like, how can I not know this? But I just didn't. Uh-huh. I just didn't.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I often think of, you know, any of these conversations bring me back to that beautiful symbol of the yin-yang symbol. You know, it's just like, it says it all. If we just meditate on that symbol, it says everything we need to know, you know, and it's a circle and it's in a dance and it's, you know, but it's the dark and the light. They're just part of each other. They're reflectors of each other.
And they require each other.
They require, yeah. And there's light in the darkness and darkness in the light. So it's just, it says it all. Yeah. And there's a real positivist movement, you know, that's been trying to happen in the last few decades. And it just doesn't include the shadow work. And I just think it's not a sustainable way of engaging reality. The shadow work is so critically important, and that's where the gold is, as Jung would say. That's where the gold lies. If you go into the shadow, that's where you get the gold.
Well, because it's part of you, right? If you're just looking for the goodness,
right,
and you're suffering inside, then you're not ever going to really be able to heal, because you're resisting, you're suppressing.
Right. Yes.
And this is more about being more fluid and flexible and going with the flow.
Right.
Know? And trust. That's the hard piece, isn't it?
Yeah. It's that, like you were quoting Rumi, of just being brought to your knees. You know, I can go along and have some really happy, sweet days, and I cherish every minute of those days. But, you know, something happens and the suffering begins and I'm brought to my knees. And, you know, there's a whole other thing breaking in that I'm grateful for, that I needed and I know I need, you know. So it's just a part of life. So, yeah, and for us to resist or think there's something wrong, or we did something wrong, or often we did do something wrong, but it's so that we can figure it out. It's all about learning every day. But to, you know, just embrace and accept and support each other and love each other through it all. So, yeah.
So what's going to happen? What's the hope? Give us a hopeful story. I mean, I hear the hope, but let's reiterate that hopefulness for what we have the power to do. Because again, I think, you know, in the same way that it can be a little bit upsetting to realize that something did go wrong and you're responsible for making it right or some sort of remediation, it's also very empowering to understand that you can do something.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so that it doesn't have to be like it doesn't have to feel like punishment. it really can shift into the realm of opportunity, and you're giving yourself the power to change your own reality.
Right. Yes, absolutely. I feel like as we move more toward our dreaming mind, as we move more toward the shamanic dimension of our own being, and as we open ourselves to the indigenous nature, you know, that vast, archaic, primordial nature in all of us, that has so much power there. You know, if we can just help each other and support each other in this process of transformation and getting out of this small mind, this rational mind that we've developed that we think is so important, and it's eradicating our connection to all of this vast information and power. And it's like in that place, we understand what the stars are saying, what the, you know, it's like we're embedded in this great cosmos. If we get there and live there together and really open ourselves to that, there's nothing we can't do. We're such a creative, powerful, positive, loving, capable of so much love, capable of so much creativity, innovativeness. I mean, there's nothing we can't do. Oh my gosh. When you look at every little like small item in our house, it's like somebody innovated this. And I thank them all the time. Even just a little switch on the window that works and it's great. I'm thinking somebody thought of this out of love for knowing we'd need this now. So, I mean, we can do all that. We can create all the ways to make a sustainable life for each other and for our future generations. We can totally do this. We can. And I think that we have the opportunity, and I hope that we will. But I don't think there's anything we can't do, even now, even though there's a lot of information to say it's almost too late. You know, I really believe that we can step in and step up and create it, but it's going to take that commitment. You know, it's going to take a commitment to being willing to take on the task of waking up. It's important that William Stafford, great poet, says it's important that wake people be awake. Wait a minute, I actually have that poem. I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs of it. Where did I brought it over in case I thought I did. Yeah. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or the breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so I feel like I'm waking up every day and I just welcome it. It's not always, you know, comfortable, but it's waking up. So it's important that awake people be awake, and that we wake each other up and support each other in this awakening. And so much powerful beauty is ready to emerge. The whole of nature is on our side. You can't go wrong.
And again, that's not a message that I ever got. So it's really important to share it and to help people understand that. You know, that it's a little more familiar that the universe is rigged against you. At least that was my life experience.
Mm-hmm.
Understand that I was just simply being shown that as you know, I just wasn't walking my true path. You know, this is not for you. And so obstacles are put in your way.
Right. Yeah. And thank God for them, right? You know, that, yeah.
And it takes sometimes a really long time to be able to thank anybody for them. But, you know, I have absolutely realized that that is possible. And my cognitive mind would have not allowed me to consider that.
Right.
It just happens.
Yeah, it just happens. It happens every day. We need each other. You know, I just love what you're doing now in terms of creating this dialogue among thinking people, and the dialogue of, you know, all of us together listening and learning, and we need each other so much. So it's not an individual work, it's a creative community of love and care.
Yes, and it's so wonderful to be a part of it with you.
Yeah, same, Gina.
So yes. I want to back up just 1 second, just because I want to make this clear to our listening audience.
Yes.
That dreams are important, but then there's the other issue of being asleep. You know, like cognitively, mentally, spiritually asleep. So can you just sort of tease those apart a little bit for me, for us?
Well, let me see if I understand. By asleep, you mean the our sort of trance state? Is that what you mean?
I want to make it clear to folks that, you know, this dream time is not the trance state.
No. Oh, thank you. Okay, I got you. Now I hear you.
It's just like, wait, you just told me you don't want me to be asleep and want to wake up, but now you want me to watch my dreams, which are part of the trance. It's like, no, that's not.
The opposite of that. It's, yeah. Who is it? There's Michel de Montaigne. I have that quote somewhere. It's you know, that many say that we waking sleep and sleeping wake. You know, and it's the awake message, like in the Manchurian Candidate. It's like these guys are in this trance. They, you know, they've got this thing. They're doing this thing, and then they go to sleep and they get what's really actually going on. And I'm telling you, I'm so glad you're asking this. Night after night, and with my clients on a daily basis, the dreams are saying what's actually going on. That's hard to decipher in this world that's in this trance state and so asleep. The dreams are awake. They are telling us the truth. They are saying what's really going on in a very deep, profound way that is hard to find in our conscious life, because our conscious life is not that trained to open itself in these ways. We've kind of moved away from it. So I'm so glad you asked that question, because I wouldn't want to leave anybody with that thought that the dreams are, you know, that sort of sleeping way. No, they are the most awake part of ourselves. They are the part that is connected to, I mean, if you look at any scripture or mythology, all of the world's scriptures, it's the dreams that came in that moved the events for the prophets, for the saints, for the, you know, all of the people. You know, Joseph heard, name him Jesus in a dream. Joseph heard, take him to Egypt in a dream. Joseph heard, marry, you know, marry her in a dream when there was, you know, some question. I mean, all these things are pretty critical to the Christian story, and it all came through a dream to a simple man who was listening to his dreams, and they knew. And every scripture, every single one of them, you'll find all the prophets listening to their dreams. It's when the dream came, that's when the action changed, because then they were told the waking story, what's really needed and what's really going on. And it's not just the prophets and the saints who get this. It's each of us every night have that access if we learn to listen to it. And somehow religions have thought only the priests or the saints or the prophets get that. And they didn't want us to feel our own connection, because what if it would contradict, you know, the priestly message or the dogma, or you wouldn't tithe if you thought you had your own connection. What, you know, it was a power and control thing to try to disconnect us from our own connection to the divine voice. So yes, I think learning to understand that, and people wake up from dreams. I do the same all the time. Like that was what that was. And then as soon as you start writing it down, it downloads. You start to get, oh, that wasn't nothing. That was really important. That was really something. Or at least it's a clue to something.
And it's not like you're getting a whole story, right? Sometimes you just have an image in a dream of something. And, you know, maybe it doesn't initially mean anything. And at least for me, you go about your business for a day or a week, and suddenly you see something like that, and then the connection is made.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's like breadcrumbs through the forest. You know, it doesn't come all in one big download. It comes through following and following and following and following. It's interesting. I had a dream just last week about a horse that was kind of like in a stall and not being fed. And I recognized it's my own horsepower that's just kind of like stalled. And so I'm figuring out what to do for myself in terms of the diet, in terms of things that sort of feed my, you know, it's like, it's showing me that my energy is not good. And so it's, you know, it's practical little things like that that help us, as well as the, you know, the major connections to the you know, the moves that we're going to make in our life, or the job we're going to take, or the relationship issue, or whatever it is. It can be that practical little thing of just get your horsepower going. You know, you're going to need this. So dreams are really practical and really revolutionary. They are radical, revolutionary ways of knowing and understanding yourself and your world. And that's why they've been put to sleep by those who wanted to be in power. Don't get me going.
No. You know, so we're really accessing all of this stuff that's stuck in the subconscious mind or unconscious mind.
Well, I would say, I'm glad you said that too, because it's not just stuck in our own little unconscious mind. It's the divine voice. It is the mind of nature. It is this great connectivity of intelligence, the sort of matrix of life and wisdom and power that is emerging, like, you know, like energy coming up out of the earth that feeds the plants. It's not just our own little makeup that creates the dream. The dream is coming from this matrix of life and of cosmic intelligence and wisdom by which we are all designed and created. We are designed and created as a cell in that great cosmic event that is this earth and this planet and this solar system and all that. So it's the voice that's telling us how to be present in this world in a creative, responsible, healthy, fun-filled, joyous, intelligent way. So it's our own personal unconscious is just a piece of that. It's personal, you know. It relates to our own history. It relates to our family's history. It often will tell us our ancestors, you know, stories even. So that personal unconscious is a piece of it, but it's definitely not the whole of it or even most of it. So that's my understanding of the dream. And I really have been listening for a long time, and I feel like and that's the indigenous understanding of the dream too, by the way. The indigenous persons get together in the morning, listen to each other's dreams, and then after they've heard all the dreams of the night, then they kind of know how to conduct the affairs of the day for the whole village. They know, you know, when to plant, you know, when the hunting's going to be good. They know the most practical things, as well as, you know, part of the cosmic story of, you know, that's, you know, their cosmology is always being revised through the dreaming. So,
it on its head that the dream is the truth and my thoughts are probably not. I mean, that's what I teach. You know, most, it's really not safe to believe everything that you think, because if you examine what you're thinking, most of it is untrue or just made up.
A lot of it, yeah. I mean, David Bohm's book, Thought as a System, just read that if anybody's interested. You know, it'll tell you how to consider your own thoughts, how the nature of thought itself, you know, that it isn't necessarily personal. It comes from somewhere that might not be even friendly to our own makeup.
I use that little circular thing of his: reality is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is dependent on what we think. What we think depends on what we look for. What we look for depends on what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. And what we take to be true is our reality. So,
whoa, that's brilliant.
You know, about looking out. So perception is at the core of this. So if I'm not looking, I'm not going to understand that I have the capacity, that I am regardless, I'm creating my own reality. But if I am seeing what is going on, that gives me the power to change.
Now you know why he's known as the father of quantum physics. You know, that physics is so valuable to understand. It's a whole revolution in the understanding of physics too.
And it's curious to me, although I guess I maybe shouldn't say this, that it's, you know, it's not brand new physics either. And why is it not more well known? Why don't we talk about it? Why isn't quantum physics the same, just as important in our language and teaching as Newtonian physics? And my personal belief is simply because we can't understand it. And therefore, in the Western medical model, at least, if I can't understand it, then it doesn't exist. It's not true. It's something imaginary. So we're not going to talk about it.
Yes, that's, I completely agree with you. And Bohm himself, you know, said that scientists, physicists, you know, people who are defending their own thought system are fundamentalists, just like any fundamentalist thinker, you know, that won't let in new information because it's defending. It's, you know, I built my career on this. I published that book. Well, how am I going to accept new information that's actually going to, you know, put some of that into question? No, won't, you know. So it's fundamentalism in thinking. It's thought itself that is the problem. That Bohm, you know, himself pointed out. It's that threat that we feel, as he said, when our thoughts are being challenged, we think we are being challenged. He said, you have to understand you're not your thought. You know, you're something completely other than the thoughts that go through your head. So if somebody's challenging your thought, it shouldn't feel hurtful to you. It's not hurtful to you. It's hurtful to your thinking. And that's not who you are. We aren't our thoughts. So it's tricky business, though, when we get into somebody challenging our thoughts and not to feel like he's, you know, he says we bring the instincts of the jungle to defending our thoughts when it, you know, it's so unnecessary. So, and that's part of the challenge now that we were talking about of waking up. You know, to not let ourselves feel threatened personally when our thoughts are threatened. And what we've been taught to be true, or what we've even think that we have, you know, had the experience that tells us that's true. When we find out maybe it isn't true, not to feel threatened by that, to be open to that. So.
Oh my gosh, Tori, this has been so awesome. And I just, I mean, I hope and think this is going to be inspirational to everybody who thinks they don't have any power, who thinks they're not connected or that they can't trust their gut or their dreams.
Right.
This has really been amazing.
Well, I just so enjoyed it, Gina. You're such a great conversationalist. You know, I feel like we could go on and on and on. It's really fun.
And maybe we will have to sometime again.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
For now, as our time runs out, is there, I think you already have given us so many pearls, but is there another piece or something else that you would like to sort of just really poke in there as our final message to really take home?
I guess the final message of just what we were saying is what's still lingering in my mind is don't be afraid to wake up.
Yes. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And let's support each other and love each other through it. You know, it can be challenging and scary. There might be tears or a stomach ache or, you know, worse. But, you know, not to be afraid of it. It's just, it's creation. It's like birth pains.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And so for those folks who are interested in learning more about dreams, you are offering participation in your global dream symposium. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
That's a free offering that Jocelyn Mercado, my colleague, and I offer every month. And if you go to my website, which I know you'll have the link on the Dream Symposium page, you'll see how to register for the Dream Symposium. And once a month we get together, and just like the indigenous people who, you know, bring the whole village dreams together, we have a global village that comes together and we share the dreams and we talk about the sort of themes and messages that are kind of hot off the press, you know, and it's amazing how you can have people from sometimes 6 or 7 different countries, 3 or 4 different continents, and they're, the dreams are all, the themes of the dreams in that month can be very similar. So we know that we're being addressed in this way and that we're all kind of part of each other. It's a fascinating experience. So it can be really lots of fun. So, it's at 1:00 Eastern time on a Friday. You can get the dates on the website, but if you can't be there in person, we'll send out the recording. If you register, you'll be on the list to get the recording. So you might enjoy, you know, just hearing the dreams of your fellow journeyers on this planet and getting just maybe a little more familiarity with the language of the dream from it. You know, that's the part of the hope, is that we all connect a little more to that dreaming mind and our collective dreaming mind. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you for offering that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you again for really a very wonderful and deep and thought-provoking transformative way of, you know, looking at how we can be in this world as it is, and find the courage to make a difference.
Yes, you're so welcome. And I do invite people, if they have comments or reflections or questions or whatever, to write to me. You can see through my website, but I appreciate the conversation and I'm open to being contacted in those ways too.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much from my heart, Tarya. This has been great.
Thank you, Gina.
Everyone who has joined us.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. I'm really, really, really happy you're doing it and happy to be a part of it.
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks. Bye.